cherish. I need to, boy, other than that, I don't put a tie on real.
This is an interview with Professor Emeritus Gerald D. Getch, School of Veterinary Medicine, Purdue University, held on November 9, 1989, in the Library Conference Room, Stewart Center, Purdue University. The interviewer is Annie Kirker, Professor and Veterinary Medical Librarian Emeritus. Jerry, would you give us some background of your pre-college years?
I was born in western Kansas, but grew up in eastern Kansas on a typical grain livestock farm. We raised a variety of animals and fowls and had a number of dogs and cats over the years. And we often called veterinarians to treat our sick animals, but I never seriously considered veterinary medicine as a career until I entered college.
Prior to coming to Purdue, I believe you attended Kansas State University. What courses of study did you pursue there, and what degrees were you awarded?
I entered Kansas State College in 1940 on a Sears Roebuck scholarship to enroll in agriculture. During my second year in college, I roomed with a student who was a first-year veterinary student, and through my conversations with him and contacts with other people in the veterinary school, I realized that a degree in veterinary medicine offered a wide variety of career opportunities. Consequently, I completed my pre-veterinary requirements during my second year in school and enrolled in veterinary medicine in the fall of 1942.
Were you in a training program associated with the armed forces?
As was the case with most students in veterinary school during this period, I enlisted in 1943 in a special program called Army Specialized Training Program, ASTP, and was assigned to continue my veterinary schooling in the Army. We were required to complete 3 full semester terms each year, and I received my DVM degree in 1945. Several persons who have been here or are and or now on the staff here at Purdue were also in those ASTP units. Dean Jack J. Stockton, Dean Erskine V. Morse, Dr. Donald P. Gustafson, Dr. Russell K. Jones, Dr. Lewis Runnels, Dr. William Pritchard are some that were assigned to these units.
After you were awarded the DVM degree in 1945, were you released from service?
I was discharged from the Army shortly before graduation.
What did you elect to do professionally in the years immediately following graduation?
I joined the tuberculosis and brucellosis testing program in the state of Illinois. A year later, I joined a private veterinary practice in Kankakee, Illinois, where I was involved in a mixed practice until 1948. I met my wife Barbara in Kankakee, and we were married in 1947.
When did you become involved in teaching?
In January 1948, I received an offer to join the faculty at the University of Missouri and take over the instruction in the course in veterinary physiology. The previous instructor and teacher had left in the middle of the course. My introduction to teaching consisted of starting in the middle of the book and finishing out the year. The fellows in the course were almost all veterans of the war and were most understanding and appreciative of my efforts. I soon realized that I was unprepared to carry full responsibility for physiology instruction, so I decided to accept a position at Oklahoma State University. There I assisted in teaching courses in physiology and pharmacology for about 4 years. During this time, I enrolled in advanced courses in biochemistry and related disciplines to increase my basic knowledge needed to teach physiology.
I believe you came to Purdue in 1952. You were awarded a master's degree in 1955 and the PhD in 1957. Why did you choose this institution for your graduate studies?
I learned from a colleague at Oklahoma State, Dr. C.H. Whitehair, that Dr. L.M. Hutchings was looking for an animal physiologist to join his research group here at Purdue. So in the fall of 1952, I was one of several who were given positions in the veterinary science department and who subsequently enrolled in graduate programs. Others who joined the staff that year included Dr. Robert Claflin, Dr. Robert Carlson, Dr. George Neer, Dr. Edward Halterman, and Dr. Dennis Sykes. I believe all of us ultimately received the PhD degree.
What were your areas of study and research?
My situation was somewhat unique in that I was the only veterinary physiologist in the group. Dr. Neer was an endocrinologist but did not have his veterinary degree at that time. The department at that time was strongly oriented toward microbiology and pathology, and strong graduate programs in these areas exist up to today. I was pretty much on my own in my selection of graduate courses and my choice of research projects. Projects in which I had some responsibility included studies of ketosis in ruminants, bloat in ruminants, dissecting aneurysms in turkeys, gastric ulcers in swine, and spinal cord regeneration in ruminants.
Who were your major professors and others who directed your work?
I was very much impressed by Dr. Hutchings and the persons in the veterinary science department. I have never been in a research department before, and the enthusiasm of the older staff members and the younger persons during my graduate work was certainly remarkable. Dr. Fred Washko was my first major professor, but he left during my first year. Dr. C.R. Donham then served as my advisor until his death in 1956. Dr. Pritchard was then my major professor until I received my PhD degree in 1957. During my graduate study, I was in charge of courses in animal anatomy and animal physiology, which were offered to undergraduate and graduate students in agriculture.
Did you anticipate the establishment of the School of Veterinary Science and Medicine during these years?
After coming to Purdue, I learned that the state legislature was considering the establishment of a veterinary school at Purdue. I do not recall that this was known to me prior to my coming. For some time, serious consideration was given to a new school, and in the spring of 1957, funds amounting to $2 million were appropriated for the initiation of construction of the school. The discussions, pro and con, became rather heated during the 1950s, and a serious rift developed between some members of the Indiana Veterinary Medical Association and members of the staff at Purdue. Support for the new school, as far as Purdue was concerned, seemed to be primarily from President Hovde and his staff. However, I always felt that Dr. Hutchings favored the establishment of the school, but realized it would greatly disrupt the activities of an excellent research group. Dr. Hutchings was in a somewhat difficult position at that time, but his mastery of diplomacy, his popularity, soon healed most of the wounds of the conflict. I know that Dr. Hutchings rejected offers of deanships at other veterinary schools during that period.
Did you have in mind the opportunities that might present themselves if such a school became a reality?
Yes, I knew that I could make a contribution to the development of such a school and its academic and research pursuits. I had been on the faculty of two veterinary schools and was aware of the challenges of such a program. News of the establishment of the school was received with mixed feelings by the staff of the Veterinary Science Department. I had just been awarded my PhD degree and was contemplating joining the research group at Eli Lilly Company or possibly joining the faculty in another veterinary school. But these possibilities were dismissed when I was given the opportunity to join the faculty of the new school at Purdue.
enabling legislation from the Indiana General Assembly in 1957 provided for the establishment of the new school and was funded in the amount of $2 million. How did Dean Hutchings and his Purdue advisors elect to utilize this? I've heard that it dug a huge hole.
During the next 3 years, I personally spent a major portion of my time with items related to the construction of the physical plant of the new school and the ordering of new equipment. It was decided that the first appropriation, the $2 million, would be used to plan the total construction program and would be used to plan the and to award contracts for as much of the construction as funds would permit. Bids were actually taken for all phases of construction before the legislative sessions of 1959 so that sufficient funds would be available for completion. The first appropriation was sufficient to build the outside walls of all of the major buildings associated with the new school.
What further appropriations were made by subsequent assemblies of the Indiana legislature, and were other sources of funding available to augment state appropriations?
Subsequent state appropriations in 1959 of $3,140,000 and a National Institute of Health grant of $300,000 were used to complete the construction and provided $1,050,000 for equipment, including all the inside furnishings, such as laboratory furniture, library furniture, etc.
With these state funds came great responsibility to utilize them to the maximum advantage. How did you become involved with the initial building plans?
Well, within a few days after the first funds were appropriated, Dr. Hutchings asked me to take over the job of being faculty coordinator for the planning of the new school and asked Bruce Hatcher, our veterinary science farm superintendent, to insist in planning new research facilities on campus and at the veterinary farm.
When was planning of the facilities initiated and when was a contract awarded?
Most of the planning of the new facilities occurred during the 1957-58 period. This was necessary since the contract for the construction of the new of the shell portion was awarded in the summer of 1958.
Who represented the university in these negotiations?
Mr. H.B. Abbott, an assistant to Mr. R.B. Stewart, was the university administrative contact, and he closely scrutinized plans being developed. He was a very capable and cooperative person who was always willing to let us incorporate new ideas into the planning process.
Who was the architect chosen to work with the administration and the faculty?
The architectural firm of Walter Scholler and Associates drew up the plans. That firm is located in Lafayette. We were able to work closely with them as construction progressed.
Were other veterinary schools visited, and were consultants brought in to assist in the planning?
Mr. Abbott, Mr. Scholler, Dr. Hutchings, and I each made trips to one or more other veterinary schools to familiarize ourselves with the latest concepts. I visited four schools with fairly new physical plants: Texas A&M, Cornell, Illinois, and Minnesota, and received blueprints from several other schools. Since we decided to pattern much of our large animal clinic after the Cornell plan, Dr. Gordon Danks of Cornell was hired as a consultant for that portion of the school. He was very helpful, convinced us that such innovations as ceramic tile stalls in the large animal clinic were feasible.
What were some of the problems encountered in your initial planning?
Well, since the existing staff members at that point were largely in microbiology and pathology, it was necessary to plan the departments of anatomy, physiology and pharmacology and a small animal clinic, pretty much from our own ideas and from advice from other schools. Members of the livestock associations, possibly with tongue in cheek, questioned our planning a small animal clinical facility. Dr. Wilson Henderson of our staff was quite concerned that we had not provided any areas for poultry medicine and felt the State Poultry Association would be displeased since they were really strong supporters of the new school.
Were other Purdue faculty and administrators involved?
Dr. Oliver Dunn developed plans for the library. Mr. Jim Blakesley of the Office of Schedule and Space was concerned with classroom size and configuration. He also insisted that we justify all major space allocations before he approved such requests.
As you look back on this planning stage, what arguable decisions turned out to be good ones?
Some items which I feel I was justified in arguing for included, number one, excavation of the entire basement for future development. The architect wished to have only mechanical equipment in the basement. Number two, we argued for large teaching laboratories with capacity for 60 students. Mr. Blakesley considered this an excessive amount of space and felt that sectioning into 30 student laboratory groups, one half of the expected enrollment, would be less expensive. Number three, a large area above the small animal clinic of unassigned research laboratories. And number four, we argued for living quarters for student interns. These have since been converted to offices.
How did you get other faculty members involved in planning specific teaching or research areas?
During the planning process, I prepared a file on each room in the school, and whenever possible or practical, a staff member was asked to make plans for that room. This worked well in some cases, but generally the details were left to me. Dr. Gustafson did a detailed planning of the tissue culture area. Dr. Robert Lewis became interested in radiology and was helpful in developing the X-ray facilities. I should note that almost everyone on the staff offered his assistance in the planning of the buildings. I recall Dr. Claflin and Dr. Hollerman made up a full-scale model of the isolation rooms for the new virus isolation building.
During the initial planning stage, did you have other teaching and or research responsibilities? Were you able to devote sufficient time to the planning function?
During the planning phases for construction, I spent a part of each day with architectural personnel. My usual procedure was to spend time with the electrical, plumbing, general construction persons, etc., and bring back questions for the staff members to assist me. During this period, I was involved in the teaching program as before and was cooperating on a number of research projects with Dr. Fred Andrews and Dr. H.D. Jackson.
What effect did the tragic illness and death of Dean Hutchings have on the planning function?
The illness and death of Dr. Hutchings was a real blow, since I would consult with him on almost any item of major consequence. Fortunately, he was available during the early planning stages, and his diplomatic approach to problems made it easier to convince the architect and the university administration that our ideas were sound.
A great milestone along the way during these early years was the groundbreaking in February 1958. What are some of your recollections of this memorable event?
Groundbreaking ceremonies for construction of the school were held in the spring of 1958. and involved the governor, Harold Handley, President Fred Hovde, Dean Hutchings, several members of the state legislature, and several members of the Board of Trustees of Purdue University.
During construction, what was your usual involvement with the architects, construction personnel, and university planners?
During the actual construction of the building, weekly meetings were held with personnel from the university and representatives of the contractors, and we went over any problems which had arisen during that week.
When was the major portion of the construction completed?
The first phase of construction had been termed the shell construction, since no inside finishing was done. The Wilhelm Construction Company was the sole contractor for the first phase and ultimately became the general contractor for the final phases of construction. The contracts for the final phase of construction were awarded separately and consisted of a general construction contract, an electrical contract, and a plumbing and heating contract. An interesting note was that the plumbing and heating contractor was unable to fulfill the contract due to his making too low a bid, and this phase was completed under a bonding arrangement. This did delay final completion for a few weeks. The major portions of the building were completed in 1960 and occupied by staff members early enough to be available for the 1960-61 academic year. Much of the equipment for the building was ordered prior to completion, and upon receipt it was stored in areas assigned to us in physical plant buildings.
The first class was admitted in the fall of 1959 before the building of Lynn Hall was completed. What were some of the problems of finding suitable space and equipment to teach the courses in the first year of the curriculum?
Well, the first class consisting of 50 students was admitted in the fall of 1959. I believe eventually 45 members of that class graduated. The first year courses in anatomy and physiology were taught in the upper floor of the veterinary pathology building. I cannot recall for sure, but I believe that the histology laboratory sessions were also conducted at that location. I have some remembrances that biochemistry and possibly bacteriology were taught over in other university departments. I do not recall any major problems arising due to the lack of facilities, although laboratory instruction was kept to a minimum.
Did you and the other faculty members involved think that this group of students were somewhat shortchanged, or did the situation lead to innovative challenges rather than frustrations?
I do not feel that the students received the level of laboratory instruction as did subsequent classes, but by and large, their training was quite adequate. The course in physiological chemistry was taught by Dr. Jackson in the Department of Biochemistry.
After Lynn Hall was available for lecture and laboratory use, what became of the veterinary pathology building?
The veterinary pathology building was then called the veterinary science building, and it was totally vacated in the summer of 1960 and was extensively remodeled. Persons from the area were temporarily housed in Lynn Hall along with the rest of the staff who moved into Lynn Hall in 1960. The veterinary pathology building became available again by the fall of 1961.
What do you recall about the dedication of Lynn Hall, or were you too exhausted to be impressed and too pleased to be relieved of this responsibility?
The dedication proceedings for the new buildings were held in the fall of 1960. I actually recall very little about this affair, other than recalling that state dignitaries and university persons were participated.
I believe that Dr. Leroy Burney, Surgeon General of the United States, attended the ceremony and challenged the faculty of the new school. You continued as building deputy and had many responsibilities of an ongoing nature in facilities planning. Are there some specific areas on which you wish to comment?
I continued to be the principal participant in planning additional new buildings and in any remodeling done in the existing buildings. Items which were accomplished later included the construction of the research animal housing facility. This was finished partly from unused construction funds called contingency funds and partly from National Institutes of Health research grant which we received. Also in the early 70s, the school received funds in the form of capitation grants from the federal government for increasing class size from 60 to 72. These funds were used for remodeling the feed storage building, adding new facilities in the basement, and a variety of other remodeling projects. As an example, the medical illustration area was enlarged using these funds. Another major remodeling project involved the completion of the north wing of the basement for the program of the Lafayette Center for Medical Education, an extension of the Indiana University Medical School. I worked closely with the groups planning these facilities. One of the more interesting problems was the planning of the county morgue in the basement. Dr. Grayson Davis, then county coroner, was largely responsible for planning this area as a part of the medical school facilities. From the time we moved into the new facilities until I took a sabbatical leave in 1978, I served as building deputy for Lynn Hall and the several buildings to the south of Lynn Hall. This job normally entails keeping records of building keys, working closely with building service persons, reporting any building problems to appropriate persons, etc. This was a major undertaking in the early days of the school, since many problems always arise in a new building.
Would you comment on the initial appointments to the administrative staff of the new school?
Dr. Hutchings was appointed to the deanship of the new school within a few weeks after the legislature passed the bill establishing the new school. That was in 1957. In June of 1959, he announced the organizational makeup of the new school into departments and also announced the appointments of heads of departments and of assistant dean. These consisted of Dr. Halterman as assistant dean, Dr. George Christensen as head of Department of Veterinary Anatomy, Dr. Claflin as head of the Department of Veterinary Microbiology, Pathology, and Public Health, Dr. John Bullard as head of the Department of Veterinary Surgery, and myself as head of the Department of Veterinary Physiology and Pharmacology. When these appointments were actually announced by President Hovde, Dean Hutchings was seriously ill in a Chicago hospital where he died in August of 1959.
Would you comment on additional appointments to the faculty?
Soon after these appointments were made, the various department heads began to assemble staff persons needed to teach the incoming class in the fall of 1959. Doctors William Teets and Richard Hughes were nearing the completion of their PhD degree programs and were assigned to the Department of Veterinary Physiology and Pharmacology. Dr. Hughes received his degree in 1960, and he was given the responsibility for organizing and teaching the courses in pharmacology. And we prevailed upon the university administration to permit us to teach the course in physiological chemistry in our department. Dr. Jackson had been an associate in several research projects and was put in charge of that course. Dr. Nair was a research person in the old veterinary science department, and he joined the staff as an endocrinologist. The only person who joined from outside the existing staff who joined the physiology group was Dr. Calvin Turbies, a member of the staff of the Indiana University Medical School. His special area of interest was neuroanatomy and neurology. Dr. Teets, Dr. Turbies, Dr. Nair, and I were all involved in the instructional program in physiology for the first few years of the new school. Persons who came into the physiology department in the first few years were persons seeking advanced degrees either in physiology or pharmacology. Dr. Terrence Curtin, Dr. Fred Raisel, Dr. James Carter, Dr. Roger Hatch, Dr. Jack Botta were the earliest group of graduate students. Somewhat later, Dr. William Carlton joined the department and was given responsibility for the course in veterinary toxicology. He later joined the staff in veterinary microbiology, pathology, and public health. Since the department also offered courses in physiology for students in agriculture and advanced courses for students throughout the university, the staff was kept very busy.
What was the relationship of the new school to Purdue's School of Agriculture and the Agricultural Experiment Station, the AES?
Since the Department of Veterinary Science was maintained as an entity in the School of Agriculture, the dean of the veterinary school was retained as head of that department. Most members of the veterinary faculty at that time were given joint appointments in the two schools and continued to have research programs in the Agricultural Experiment Station.
Was there a basic course of study formulated prior to the planning of facilities such as clinics, laboratories, classrooms, offices, and ancillary services such as medical illustration and the library?
No, actually the building plans were developed prior to the formulation of the curriculum because of the press of time for presentation to the state legislature. A curriculum committee and the admissions committee were appointed soon after the establishment of the school. Other committees such as the Library and Audiovisual Committee, Scholarships Standards Committee, Research Committee, etc., were also formed early in the development of the school.
Thank you, Dr. Getch, for your interest and cooperation in making this interview possible. Your involvement in facilities planning as well as the academic development of the new School of Veterinary Science and Medicine is of considerable historical interest. For me, this represents the culmination of a long and pleasant professional relationship between two persons who were involved in the early and formative years of the school. The tapes and transcription of the interview will become a part of Purdue University archives, which assures a lasting recognition of the role you have played and provides an historical perspective for scholars of the future.
Anne, it's been a real pleasure for me to work with you in the preparation of this oral history. I wish to express my appreciation to you for the efforts you are making in the preparation of this historical material regarding the Purdue School of Veterinary Medicine.
This is the end of the interview with Professor Emeritus Gerald D. Getch. The interviewer was Anne E. Kirker.